as we've examined it and as we've looked at it, we've recognized that this is a very unusual thing. To draw near to a holy God is not something that, at some level, everyone can say, oh yeah, I've had this specific experience, or I had this thing that occurred, and wow, I mean, that was when I drew near to God. It seems like in many cases, especially the people that we've looked at, it's been in varying ways, in varying degrees, especially when you look at Abraham. Remember, as we looked at Abraham, the way that God revealed himself, he unfolded himself to Abraham, was very different every time it happened. So if you think about it, you know, at one point, God showed up and told Abraham in a dream that he wanted him to do this thing or that thing. And then another time he came walking down a path toward his tent. And other times God would reveal himself in other ways, through circumstances, through other people. I mean, God had this myriad of ways that he showed himself to Abraham. And you look at that and you think, wow, it's pretty interesting that God did that. And I know that you guys, I think Dana said it was my favorite example. And I think you're probably right. My favorite illustration of the struggle that we have with that is with Elijah, when he saw God in magnificent ways and wondrous ways, as God did all these wonderful things for him to reveal himself to him, Elijah individually, but also the nation of Israel through Elijah. And then Elijah gets to this place where he's very comfortable knowing and understanding God in that fashion. And God comes along and he says, now I feel like I would rather whisper. I'd rather you understand me in the still smallness that I can also be in. And Elijah seemed unwilling at some level to encounter God that way. He didn't want a God that would sometimes whisper. He would rather have a God that was always flashy, always very big and in your face. And this God that seems to be small and whisper just to me on an individual level, it's a little too intimate at some level. And I wonder if that wasn't part of the problem. But more specifically for Elijah, I think that the terror, his own fear had overtaken him, and he couldn't understand that in a whisper, God is still powerful. And he began to lose sight of that. But God reveals himself to us in so many different ways, in so many different fashions, and all of that is intended to draw us near to God. We looked last week at one particular guy, Ezekiel, who saw the Lord. He encountered God, and God transformed Ezekiel. He made Ezekiel who he wanted to be as a result of that. And we saw in Ezekiel chapter 3, verses 23 and 24, this is sort of the end of the section that we're going to look at this morning, but this is sort of the pinnacle, or I guess for me, the tipping point of this narrative, where you see that drawing near of God into the life of Ezekiel and what it resulted in. Verse 23 and 24, so I arose, this is Ezekiel, I arose and went out into the valley. And behold, the glory of the Lord stood there, like the glory that I had seen by the Chebar Canal. And I fell on my face, but the Spirit entered into me and set me on my feet. And he spoke with me and said to me, go. This is what happened as Ezekiel encountered the majesty and glory of God. Now, one of the things that I find interesting about this is that it talks about the glory of God standing in a valley. And that's an interesting concept, you know, because usually, especially us, we think of the glory of the Lord, and we struggle with this at some level. We think of it in very non-tangible ways. I think we often think of the glory of God, and we think of it as some type of feeling or some type of emotion that we have. And that's the glory of God. And when I see him working out practically in lives around me, I suppose I can see him in that way as well. But as a general rule, we don't consider the glory or the majesty of God as something that is actually tangible, something that's real, something that can stand in a valley. I mean, that's place and time. That's actually the spot where the glory of God was. Why does that matter? Why would it be important for us to understand, and why would it have been important for Ezekiel to understand the glory of God in that way? As a physical locality. Doesn't that seem a little weird to you? Doesn't it seem a little strange? Do we see that any other place where the glory of the Lord is contained within time and space? It's actually contained in a certain spot? Where else do we encounter that? Yes, sir. Jesus. That was my last example. Why did you have to start there? No, that's true. In Jesus, right? If you consider, how is that the glory of God contained in a singular point? If you have seen God, if you have seen Christ, you have seen the Father. And we've talked about what is the essence of glory. It's the character of God. When you look on Christ, you see the glory and majesty of God contained within an individual. That's an astounding thing. Where else do we see that? Where else do we encounter the glory of God contained within time and space? In the tabernacle, right? They build this tabernacle, this moving temple. And they have it consecrated. And what occurs? the glory of the Lord fell from heaven and filled the tabernacle. And the majesty of God was evident to anybody who saw it. They were aware, physically, tangibly, that God was present in that place. And because of that, they had appropriate fear and reverence for that place. They recognized God is with us. What happened when we were looking at Aaron and the story of Aaron and specifically of Moses, what happened that made people so fearful? The glory of the Lord left the tabernacle, right? And they saw it go, and they were terrified. They were afraid because they recognized God was saying, I can't be with this people. My glory can't reside within this people. They are sinning and choosing to rebel against my design, and so I can't be here. So the glory of the Lord departs. And you hear that happen often, right? The glory of the Lord departed. The glory of the Lord left. It came and it left. That is a very interesting concept. One other spot that you see the glory of God. So the glory of God, what are we talking about? What is the glory of God? It's his character, it's his nature, correct? When we talk about the glory of God, don't think of it like some kind of idea. It's very easy to comprehend in the sense that it's the nature of God. Now, it's not easy to comprehend because the nature of God, as we've already described, is magnificently large, huge beyond comprehension. Who can know it? And yet we're told we can know it because he draws near. But the glory of God is his character, his person, and his nature. So God is singular, correct? God is individual and singular, right? There is a God. And yet we also recognize that in the person of Christ, that is also God, right? As part of the triune nature of God. So the glory of God, was it any less in Christ than it was anywhere else? No, it's still God. It's still his essential character. It's still God. Is there any other person in the Trinity that contains or has that nature or character? The Spirit of God, right? The Spirit of God. In fact, if you notice here, the Spirit entered into me and set me on my feet. I encountered the glory of God, and as a result of that, Ezekiel had the Spirit of God possessed him. He came inside of him, and he set him on his feet, physically took him, and said, get off your face, get on your feet, I have a job for you to do. That's also part of the glory of God. Is that contained in a physical locality? Is the Spirit contained within a physical location? You say yes. Oh, you're pointing at yourself and them as well. Very good. Thank you. That's a way to answer the question without even using your voice. That's impressive. The glory of God is contained in the person of the Spirit of God as well. And we're told that we are the temple of the Holy Ghost. The power of God, the majesty and the character of God has come to reside within us in the person and work of the Spirit of God. So when we talk about a reflection of the glory of God through an individual person, what are we talking about? I am physically manifesting the glory of the character of my Maker as the Spirit works through me. This is an astounding reality, and it becomes more connected to reality, I think. Because we would rather at some level, I would rather at some level think of it in a distance. Think of it as a thought or an idea, rather than in physical, real terms. The glory and majesty of God is seen through me. That is a terrifying, but at the same time exhilarating concept. To consider that the glory of God is supposed to be seen physically, tangibly through me and my action. It becomes very unusual because suddenly, immediately our thought is, well, not me. Don't you recognize that I am sinful, I am wicked, and I have a tendency to actually distract from God's glory rather than show the glory of God? I am a worthless, useless vessel to be displaying that glory. God, why don't you instead use something more magnificent like fire or like a shining light or do something besides me? And God says, I want to display my glory through weakness, through you. That is how I have chosen to reveal myself, is through you. And the weakness that you possess is a wonderful expression of my glory because it's clear, just like fire or some other tangible thing that God can reveal himself in. It has no worth or value intrinsically in terms of expressing the glory of God with itself until God uses it. Then it becomes magnificent. That's what we encounter when we look at the person of Ezekiel, is this glory displayed to Ezekiel. Now remember, we looked last week about the individual, Ezekiel himself. And we started by looking at verses 1 through 3. And the reason we looked at this prophecy of Ezekiel and started in verse 1 through 3 is because that's where you're introduced to the individual Ezekiel. And it's very important to know and understand the individual, because often we like to drop ourselves into the middle of the narrative and forget that this guy has a life. He has things that have occurred in his existence that helps us to get a better picture of what it was like when he had that encounter with God. So in those first three verses, it talks about the fact that Ezekiel, in the 30th year, and then he describes this very specific time and place. Why did he do that again? Why do we suspect that he was so specific and so very narrow in the way that he described the details of this vision? What was his job? He was a scribe, right? This was his instinct, is to keep track of time and history. This is what he did. This is his job. So he begins to write, and he says, this was the exact time and place and moment in time that this occurred. That matters. That actually matters a whole lot, because again, it adds concrete time and space to this description of the glory of God. It's no longer this idea that's out there. No, this was actually at this point, on this moment, and in addition, he even gives a physical description of where he was when it occurred. Where was he? You guys remember? I'm going to make you guys say it, because I said it a bunch, and I say it different every time I say it. Where was he? Thank you. By the Tibar Canal. That's right. This canal that connects the Euphrates and the Tigris River. This is an irrigation ditch. All right. And it's a very magnificent one. So don't think of it like you envisioned the ones around here. But still, I mean, it's water flowing. So he says, it was this time. It was this place. And it was very specific. I saw the Lord. He wants to give us this connection in time and space. And so we have to recognize the value of that connection in time and space. He describes these events. Now, the thing that we talked about last week was that this actually happened in a very specific period in the history of the nation of Israel. It most likely happened in 593 BC, because Jehoiakim, remember we looked in 1 Kings, how Jehoiakim had taken responsibility of the kingship there, and Nebuchadnezzar sends servants. I like remembering that narrative when Nebuchadnezzar sends his servants. He doesn't send his best army, he just sends some of those that didn't have anything better to do. Hey, why don't you go sack Jerusalem? Why don't you take some of that for me? And they go and they attack the city of Jerusalem. And in the process, Jehoiakim actually just surrenders. They don't even get to fight. Remember the 10,000 mighty men of valor that get taken? Well, 10,000 of the best, which include the mighty men of valor, get taken back to Babylon. And they didn't even get a chance to fight. They just basically were immediately surrendered. The king says, never mind, I don't want to fight you. And so they're taken and they are exported to Babylon. And that's where Ezekiel finds himself. He says, I was in Babylon by the Chebar Canal. The thing that's important there is that you recognize that who was it that Nebuchadnezzar took again? The best and the brightest. So that includes Ezekiel. So he had a promising future. I think we need to recognize that this guy had a plan. It wasn't like he was just sitting around doing nothing and they said, well, hey, why don't you come? He seemed like he was going someplace, and enough so that he got the attention of these people who were trying to strip the city of all of its potential hope. And they say, Ezekiel, you are in the priestly line. It appears that you're probably the upper crust of the priesthood. You also will be coming with us. It also says that it was in the 30th year. Oh, wait, before we go there, remember, Jehoiakim was taken to Jerusalem in 597 BC. Jerusalem was sacked in 588. So 4 years after Jehoiakim was there, but a few years before Jerusalem was sacked finally. So there was still this interim period. And during that time, Ezekiel actually, even in part of his understanding, hears of the destruction of Jerusalem while he's in the opposing country's nation. I mean, while he's there, he hears that Jerusalem has been taken. So that's his situation, right? And he's 500 to 800 miles probably from Jerusalem and the temple of God. It talked about the 30th year. What was the significance of the 30th year? He says, in the 30th year, why did he take that and mention that specifically, do we suppose? Does anybody recall? Right. The priesthood. So he was a scribe in training up to that point. He was a scribe, a priestly scribe who was in the process of becoming this actually very recognized, one of very few people who had a responsibility to serve God in the temple. That was what he was working for, and it appears that he was doing it well, because he was recognizable when they came through to strip the religious and the political and the social upper crust. He was in that process. He was right on the doorstep of that occurring. He was almost to where he had his whole dream realized, and then he's taken by this army and moved 500 to 800 miles away from his dream, from his hope, from anything that he was working toward. He's now 30. This is the 30th year. This was supposed to be the beginning of his career. And instead, he's sitting by an irrigation ditch in an occupying nation's city, looking at the debauchery and all of this cultural misunderstanding around him. I mean, we don't even comprehend in our own mind how difficult this would be to be in that environment. I mean, you can't really, you're under suspicion, right? The opposing army has brought you to this place, and it's not like you have free run of the place. I mean, you're very, they got their eye on you because they don't want to create insurrection. They wouldn't bring you and then say, hey, go do your thing. I mean, you were probably fairly well corralled and contained. They had very specific intention for you. Have we seen anybody else in the same type of situation who were contemporaries of Ezekiel? Anybody that gives us an insight into what it was like for these guys, these exiles who were in Babylon? Any ideas? Any recollection? Shadrach, Meshach, maybe, and Abednego, that might be somebody we could send her. Daniel, perhaps. I mean, these were guys who were, you could see the inner workings of the mind and heart of the nation. What were they trying to do? In Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's case, what were they trying to do? What was their goal for these people that they brought back to Babylon? To enculturate them, to indoctrinate them to their ideas, to take advantage of their talent and ability. So Ezekiel's probably not much different than they were either. He's probably under a constant barrage of culturally aberrant or bad things that they wanted him to be part of. I mean, this is a difficult place to find himself. He's not what he's doing what he wants to do. He's being forced to do things he doesn't want to do. And he's in this nation, right? 30 years old. We saw that in Numbers. And then a difficult message is received from God's prophet in Jerusalem, right? Remember Jeremiah in 29:1-14, Jeremiah sends the message to those that were in exile in Babylon. What was the message that was brought to them? Get comfortable. That is a horrifying message. We cannot, and I know I said this last week, but you gotta keep this in mind. They have just received a terrible, horrifying, the most discouraging thing you could possibly imagine has just been told these people as they're sitting waiting for God to take them back to their nation, to take them back to where they wanted to be. God says through the prophet Jeremiah, listen, it's gonna be 70 years. But buy a house, get some land, have a family, find a wife among the exiles that are there, or even among those, he even says, perhaps those that are there culturally. And then the last piece of it, remember? What was the last piece? Pray for the welfare of Babylon. Pray for the well-being of this place that you're at. Yes, I recognize that you're not in Jerusalem. We don't understand that at some level because we've never really been in a spot where we're refugees. We've never encountered that. But the difficulty of having somebody come and bring us into prison, really, and it's nice prison, but it's still prison, and to have our God, the one who's supposed to protect and provide for us and our well-being, the one who has promised from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that he would give us a nation and a land and a people and a heritage, that God has said, hey, relax, you'll be here a bit. That was awful to hear for them. This would have broken their heart. 70 years. How old would he be? 100 years old, if he lives that long. That is a long time to be under that kind of obligation, to be praying for my captors so that God can bless me through them. Listen, one of the hardest things to do, and it's still true, is to receive the blessing of God through your enemy. I mean, think of that for a moment. Envision for yourself, if God began to show his good hand and his graciousness through your enemy, that is difficult on a number of levels. For one thing, you think, God, why are you blessing him? And I get the crumbs that fall off his table. I get the blessing as it filters through them. I mean, look what they have. And yeah, at least I have food and I've got a house, but look where it's coming from. It's placing you in a position of subservience to the people that God is blessing, right? At some level, if I'm praying for their blessing so that I can get some of it, it's almost like I'm placing myself below them. And suddenly God seems to love the enemy more than me. I mean, this would have blown the minds of these captives. So much so that you recognize in that story when Jeremiah says, he's like, look, there are a lot of prophets there that are going to tell you, oh, God's coming back. It's going to be soon. We're going to be rescued very shortly. Put your sword in its sheath and get ready. I'm sure they didn't have a sword. They probably wouldn't have let him have that. But, you know, get yourself ready because we're going to be able to be restored to the nation of Israel. And instead, Jeremiah comes along and says, that's a lie. Well, at least it was a hopeful lie. I'd almost rather believe that one at some level. At least it provided me with some sense of confidence that I'm not going to entirely lose my national identity and my cultural identity, and I'm just going to become one of the herd here in Babylon. I mean, at least I can follow that idea idealistically and say, well, okay, good, hurrah, we can gather around and create our own little insurrection. That's not what God expected. That's not what he wanted. That was a horrifying message to hear. And that was what Ezekiel was privy to. This message from God. So that's the circumstances. That's where he finds himself. We've already talked about the conditions that he's in. So God makes contact with Ezekiel, and we looked at this last week as well for a little bit. He says, this is what occurred. In this moment, in this time and space, God came and revealed himself to me. So let's go ahead and get ourselves back in line with this story. In Ezekiel, almost there. Chapter 1, and we'll read verses 4 to 28. So there, he gives us time and space, he gives us context, and then he begins to describe what he encounters as he sees the glory of the Lord. And we're not going to spend a ton of time discussing this, but let's get a running start into where we're headed this morning. And as I looked, behold, a stormy wind came out of the north, and a great cloud with brightness around it, and fire flashing forth continually. And in the midst of the fire there was gleaming metal, and from the midst of it came the likeness of four living creatures. And this was their appearance. They had a human likeness, but each had four faces, and each of them had four wings. Their legs were straight, and the soles of their feet were like the soles of a calf's foot. And they sparkled like burnished bronze. Under their wings on their four sides they had human hands. And the four had their faces and their wings thus. Their wings touched one another. Each one of them went straight forward without turning as they went. As for the likeness of their faces, each had a human face. And four had the face of a lion on the right side, and four had the face of an ox on the left side, and four had the face of an eagle. Such were their faces. And their wings were spread out above. Each creature had two wings, each two covered their bodies, and each went straight forward. Wherever the spirit would go, they went, without turning as they went. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, like the appearance of torches moving to and fro among the living creatures. And the fire was bright, and out of the fire went forth lightning, and the living creatures darted to and fro, like the appearance of the flash of lightning. Now as I looked at the living creatures, I saw a wheel on the earth beside the living creatures, one for each of the four of them. As for the appearance of the wheels and their construction, their appearance was like the gleaming of beryl, and the four had the same likeness, their appearance and construction being as it were a wheel within a wheel. And when they went in any of their four directions without turning as they went, and their rims were tall and awesome, and the rims of all four were full of eyes all around. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went beside them. And when the living creatures rose from the earth, the wheels rose. Wherever the spirit wanted to go, they went. And the wheels rose along with them, for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. When those went, these went. And when those stood, these stood. And when those rose from the earth, the wheels also rose along with them, for the spirit of the living creatures was on the wheels. Over the heads of the living creatures there was a likeness of an expanse, shining like awe-inspiring crystal, spread out above their heads. And under the expanse their wings were stretched out straight, one toward another. And each creature had two wings covering its body. And when they went, I heard the sound of their wings like the sound of many waters, like the sound of the Almighty, a sound of tumult, like the sound of an army. And when they stood still, they let down their wings. And there came a voice from above the expanse over their heads. When they stood still, they let down their wings. I want to stop there for just a second and remind ourselves what he's seeing. And he's very descriptive. And again, you can't help, but I think it's very helpful, at least for me, to recognize his occupation. It's so obvious when you read this. You're like, dude, you're definitely a scribe. I mean, you're just telling us all of this very specific, very detailed. And he's trying to, you know, you can kind of see him reaching for ideas. It's sort of like a wheel within a wheel. And he's trying his best to get all these details. And he says, and as I look, I record, and I look, and I see, and I remember, and I record. And it seems in some way like there's this almost this intellectual idea that comes into play here. Now, he's still very amazed. He says, it was awesome. The rims were awesome. I don't think I've ever remember that scripture would say that. That might be a theme verse for some people with their vehicles. But you have this whole thing, and you have this description going along, and you're like, okay, I see this picture, and I understand it. And he's describing it in great detail. And then he describes the sound. It's like he doesn't even want us to miss the sound, because the sound is a big part of this, right? The sound is, you could see something amazing, but until you hear the sound, it just doesn't have that same awe-inspiring effect. Understand, with our family especially, this was very important to us when it comes to the 4th of July. So everybody likes fireworks. They're wonderful. They're awesome. Boom. Wow, that was cool. And then fire falls and ooh and ah, and everyone claps a little bit. But we had a very specific tradition growing up that you had to be in a very specific spot. And the spot had less to do with the visibility, because fact is, sometimes you wouldn't be able to see it. Either it was up too high or there are trees or different things, but that spot was, we found, sort of the sweet point of the sound, right? You could just feel it every time it hit you, boom, and it just shook you to your core. And it added this whole new dimension, especially for me when I was Nathaniel's age and screaming my head off, hiding under, you know, a blanket. Ah! I wasn't scared. I was just trying to sing. And the sound makes, it adds to the drama, it adds to the dimension, and the sound, just the feeling of that sound, makes it more clear. And he begins to describe this sound, and he says it's like the thunder of battle. It's like the sound of a roaring waterfall. It's the sound of the Almighty. He wants us to hear the sound, to see the sights, to experience what he saw, and he describes it in great detail. And then in verse 26, he starts with something new. He's already kind of gave us a little bit, but he just gave us a hint. He's talking about the creatures, and they're flashing around, and they're wheeling around, and they're doing all these things, and there's eyeballs everywhere, and he's doing all this, and then suddenly, in verse 26, he's described this above this expanse, above what you see, above the tumult, and above the lightning, and the power, and the majesty of these creatures. Over their heads was the likeness of a throne, in appearance like sapphire. And seated above the likeness of the throne was a likeness with a human appearance. And upward from what was the appearance of his waist, I saw, as it were, gleaming metal, like the appearance of fire enclosed all around. And downward from what had the appearance of his waist, I saw, as it were, the appearance of fire, and there's a brightness all around him. And like the appearance of the bow that is in the cloud on the day of rain, so was the appearance of the brightness all around. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell on my face. You would think for a moment that when you see all of this wonder and majesty from these terrifyingly weird creatures darting to and fro, sound of thunder and all this, you would think that would have caused him to freak out. But when he saw the glory of God, I fell on my face. And I heard the voice of one speaking. And he said to me, "Son of man, stand on your feet, and I will speak with you." And as he spoke to me, the Spirit entered into me and set me on my feet. And I heard him speaking to me. As soon as God comes to Isaiah, or to Ezekiel in this case, it requires the power of the Spirit of God to stand in the presence of that majesty. Right? It required an act of the Spirit of God to bring him up from his posture of absolute terror and fear. The Spirit of God came into me and stood me on my feet and said, "Listen, it needs the power of God in this, because you're standing before the holiness of God himself. You can't do this on your own. You need God to do this in you." So the Spirit comes and he enables him to stand on his feet. And God says, "I have something I want to tell you." And I heard him say to me, "Son of man, I send you to the people of Israel, to nations of rebels who have rebelled against me. They and their fathers have transgressed me to this very day. The descendants are impudent and stubborn. I send you to them and you shall say to them, 'Thus says the Lord God.' And whether they hear or refuse to hear, for they are a rebellious house, they will know that a prophet has been among them. And you, son of man, be not afraid of them, nor be afraid of their words, though briars and thorns are with you, and you sit on scorpions. Be not afraid of their words, nor be dismayed at their looks, for they are a rebellious house. And you shall speak my words to them, whether they hear or refuse to hear, for they are a rebellious house." I get the impression that he wants Ezekiel to understand something specific about the message that he's bringing. A lot of times when people say something over and over again, it's so you'll remember it. What do you suppose God wanted Ezekiel to remember about the call that he is giving him? Have you noticed anything in particular that seems to be maybe a theme? You are talking to a rebellious house, don't forget it. These are rebels. They are rebelling against me. Even to this very day, they are still rejecting me. Why do you suppose it was that God allowed in 588 for the nation of Israel, for Jerusalem, to be sacked in its entirety? And remember, we talk about the fact that Nebuchadnezzar divided asunder the implements of the temple. I mean, and he spread out and he decimated every piece of it. Why? Why would God allow that to occur? Because they are a rebellious house. They are unwilling to listen and obey the voice of God. And the message that Ezekiel is bringing to this rebellious house is that God is unwilling to continue to allow that. He's unwilling to let it continue. That will not happen. You will be punished. That is a difficult message to bring. So sometimes we think of this and we struggle to attach it to reality. The call of God for Ezekiel. And remember, we're looking at it from his perspective as he's drawn near to God. The call of God on Ezekiel was to speak to a rebellious house. That is not fun. I don't know how many of you have a rebellious house. If you do, you probably shouldn't say so. But I can tell you with certainty that when you come into a situation where you encounter rebellion, an absolute rejection of truth, we were talking a little bit about this at the Theology and Coffee with the whole concept of how do you engage these online forums with you know, where people are bashing Christianity and they're just doing dumb things and making stupid arguments that are actually full of holes, and your instinct, your gut is to say, and you start typing away, and you're like, I don't think that's right, and don't you? And what is the result in, you know, practically speaking? That's what I do, by the way. I'm sure that's not what you do. Mine, actually, it's more like this. What is the result of that in usually? It's really effective, right? People are like, oh, thank you for coming on and adding a breath of fresh air to our discussion. Thank you for adding light from the other side. I really appreciate, you know, you've got some good points, and I'll have to ponder those. I really am very, very pleased that you're with us today. That's not the result. What is usually the result? You get the arguments get stupider. More stupider. It gets dumb. It doesn't go anywhere. Why? Because they're rebellious. They have no desire for truth. They're not there hoping to know and learn something new. They're there to revel in their ignorance. And so if you step into that and try to introduce logic to the idea or try to introduce truth to that, they want nothing of it. And you will be called every name under the sun that you probably shouldn't ever be called again. And you're going to be torn to pieces, and people are going to hate you and put a pox upon all of your family to the fifth and sixth generation. And I mean, that's the reality of rebellion. So the message that God is calling Ezekiel to is to speak to a rebellious house who are stuck in a situation. I mean, it'd be one thing if they were comfortable. I mean, if you get somebody comfortable, they're full, they're fat, they're happy, there's no problem. All right, we'll listen to your argument because I have nothing better to do today. But he's talking to a rebellious house that is in the middle of punishment, right? So they're in the middle of being punished, and that's where God calls them. They are not going to be receptive to this message. And God tells him again and again and again, whether they hear it or not, they're rebellious, and you have to say it. You are going to that kind of audience. Don't forget. Ezekiel, don't forget. They're rebellious. They're not going to listen to you. But what will they know? They will know that a prophet has been among them. They will know that somebody came and told them the truth. Why? Why did God want them to remember that a prophet was among them? So that 70 years from now, when their eyes have finally, when they have, their will has been crushed, and they are finally returning to seek after God, when Ezra and Nehemiah come along and begin to introduce truth back into the picture and scripture is read, then they will see the goodness of God, that in the midst of their sin and in the midst of their own rebellion, God was continuing to pursue them to the banks of the Chebar in Babylon. That's the God that we serve. In the midst of our rebellion, God continues to pursue us. He tells us the truth. And he knows often that the truth is the last thing we want to hear, but he graciously pursues us. That is an amazing God. That is a God that is so much more gracious than I will ever hope to be. I guarantee you, if I was in God's shoes, or even if I was in Ezekiel's shoes, I'd say, why bother? Why let them experience the full wrath of God? Let them be completely lost and decimated and crushed. That was the message that essentially Moses was not baited into, but at some level God says, okay, let's wipe them out and let's start over with you. And Moses said no, because he interceded on their behalf as a picture of the work and person of Christ. He said, in their rebellion, they are still your chosen people. They are still the ones who are the recipients of your covenant. God continued to extend grace and mercy, and God does it. And it's an astounding reality that they have. This is the call of God to Ezekiel. But you, son of man, hear what I say to you. Be not rebellious like that rebellious house. So now it gets personal with Ezekiel. It wasn't enough that he was in this spot, but now God gets personal with him and says, you don't be rebellious. Open your mouth and eat what I give you. And then when I looked, behold, a hand was stretched out to me, and behold, a scroll in the book, the scroll of a book was in it. And he spread it before me, and it had writing on the front and on the back. And there were written on it words of lamentation and mourning and woe. And he said to me, and son of man, eat whatever you find here. Eat this scroll and go speak to the house of Israel. I like that God told him to eat the scroll. And you know what's interesting? What do we know about that scroll? It has woe and lamentation written on it. What we don't know. And it tastes terrible. And it causes problems for Ezekiel. That's all we know. We know just the imagery. We don't even know what it said because that wasn't what God wanted us to understand. The thing about the prophet Ezekiel, and in fact we'll see this in a second, is that he was more about the picture and less about the words. And it's interesting how God used him that way. God wanted Ezekiel to be a picture for Israel. And words seemed less important at some level. But he does definitely speak. But specifically here, he eats. So I opened my mouth, and he gave me the scroll to eat. And he said, son of man, feed your belly with the scroll that I give you and fill your stomach with it. And I ate, and it was in my mouth as sweet as honey. I find that interesting as well. What does this scroll contain? Words of woe and lamentation, and yet somehow it tastes sweet. Why would there be that discrepancy? Wouldn't you assume that it would taste awful, bitter, horrible, terrible? It's the words of God, and even in judgment, it continues to provide nourishment and sweetness. And he said to me, son of man, go to the house of Israel and speak with my words to them. For you are not sent to a people of foreign speech and of a hard language, but to the house of Israel. Not to many peoples of foreign speech and a hard language whose words you cannot understand. Surely, if I sent you to such, they would listen to you. But the house of Israel will not be willing to listen to you. For they are not willing to listen to me, because all the house of Israel has a hard forehead and a stubborn heart. That is poetic right there. They have a hard forehead or a hard face. They are hard-headed. Have you ever thought of that word as being a biblical one? Because it is. You, friend, have a hard forehead. Nothing is going to make it through. You are resistant entirely to the truth of God. God says, hey, if I would have called you as a missionary to Zanzibar, where you had to learn their language, they would probably listen to you. And immediately you want to raise your hand and say, God, let's do that one. If that makes more sense in my mind that we should go to people that are willing. God says, no, I am sending you to the stubborn, the stiff-necked, the hard-headed. And it's going to be easy to say it, but they're not going to listen. Wow. They have the hard forehead. And a stubborn heart. Behold, I have made your face as hard as their faces, and your forehead as hard as their foreheads. This looks like a battle ready to begin. It's like rugby. Like emery, harder than flint, I have made your forehead. Fear them not, nor be dismayed at their looks, for they are a rebellious house. Moreover, he said to me, son of man, all my words that I shall speak to you, receive in your heart and hear with your ears, and go to the exiles and to your people and speak to them and say to them, thus says the Lord God, whether they hear or refuse to hear. Then the Spirit lifted me up, and I heard behind me the voice of a great earthquake. Blessed be the glory of the Lord from its place. And it was the sound of the wings of the living creatures as they touched one another, and the sound of the wheels beside them, and the sound of a great earthquake. And the Spirit lifted me up and took me away, and I went in bitterness and the heat of my spirit, and the hand of the Lord was strong upon me. And I came to the exiles of the Tel Abib, who were dwelling by the Chebar Canal, and I sat where they were dwelling. And I sat there overwhelmed among them 7 days. This is where it gets interesting. I mean, it's already been interesting, but now we begin to encounter the reality of the consequences of this reality or this narrative. So Ezekiel is in this spot, and God shows him this, and he says, this is my message. This is my call. You're going to rebellious, stiff-necked, hard-headed people who will not listen to you. And it says that after he was finished, after he's eaten this scroll of woe, after God has told him, I'm going to use you to display to my people judgment, then I'm lifted by the Spirit, and I hear the angels and all of those things that I saw behind me as I'm being as I'm being removed from the place that I was, and I'm hearing them say, "Behold, the glory of the Lord is in its place." This is a protection of the glory and the holiness of God. The things that occurred here and the majesty that's described in this place is all part of this imagery of the glory and magnificence that Ezekiel encountered. But it says something about Ezekiel's heart. What does it say happened as he left? I was raised in what? In the heat and anguish of my spirit. And the hand of the Lord was heavy upon me. And he sits for 7 days among the exiles in Tel Aviv there. By this channel, he sits in silence for 7 days, overwhelmed with the call of God. And the overwhelming call of God was not this joy, this rapture, this wondrous pleasure. The heaviness, the burning of his own desire for his people was conflicted by the judgment of God. And for 7 days, he was overwhelmed by what God had asked him to do. But God had promised him something very specific. What resource did Ezekiel have? God says, "I will harden your forehead like flint. I will make you stubborn and strong. I will cause your commitment to truth to be as hard as the commitment to rebellion. And it will create woe and lamentation and fighting. And it will be miserable for you. And you will spend your time fighting against untruth. But I am still the one that will provide for you in that." None of us are comfortable. I'm telling you this right now. If you say you're comfortable with this, then you've never experienced it. None of us are comfortable with encountering or drawing near to God in this way. See, the thing is, we're often thinking of this drawing near to God, and we think, oh, won't it be wonderful? My God will be loving me, and I will be loving him, and I will experience the joy of fellowship with him. Yes, yes, and yes. But he has not assured or promised that the call that he has for you won't require a forehead like flint as you combat rebellion and untruth. And it is not fun. There are some people that say, "Oh yeah, I'm cool with that. I like being, the counterpoint. I'm cool with being able to sort of just fight my culture." Listen, that's not what's going on here. He's not fighting the culture, right? What is he fighting? He's fighting his own culture, his own people. He's not fighting the ungodly culture. He's praying that they prosper. He is fighting his own desires. He is part of that nation. He is brought up in that understanding. What is he fighting? His own self. He's part of the problem. He said, "Don't be rebellious like this people." God pointed out the fact that Ezekiel himself had a lot of those same tendencies. And the reason that his forehead had to be hardened like flint is because otherwise he would sell out too, just like all the other people that are part of his culture. It is a difficult call that we have to defend truth in the face of other people who claim to have the same truth. That is hard to do. It's not fun. It doesn't make you popular among those that say that they believe and know God. But it's a reality that God calls us to as we see him and his nature and glory. And it is a difficult thing. For 7 days, he sits in that room in silence, in prayer, in meditation, alone. He couldn't speak. He didn't want to speak. It was a terrifying spot for him to be. Overwhelmed by the call of God. And at the end of 7 days, verse 18, the word of the Lord came to me and said, "Son of man, I have made you a watchman for the house of Israel, a warrior, a watchman. You have been called to duty. Whenever you hear a word from my mouth, you shall give them warning from me. If I say to the wicked, 'You shall surely die,' you will give him no, and you give him no warning or speak to warn, nor speak to warn the wicked of his from his wicked way in order to save his life. That wicked person shall die for his iniquity, but his blood I will require at your hand. But if you warn the wicked, and he does not turn from his wickedness or from his wicked way, he shall die for his iniquity, but you will have delivered your soul. Again, if a righteous person turns from his righteousness and commits injustice, and I lay a stumbling block before him, he shall die. Because you have not warned him, he shall die for his sin, and his righteous deeds that he has done shall not be remembered. But his blood I will require at your hand. But if you warn the righteous people, a person not to sin, and he does not sin, he shall surely live, because he took warning, and you will have delivered your soul." I mean, God is laying the responsibility of the blood of his people at his feet. This is a heavy hand of God. And the hand of the Lord was upon me there, and he said, Arise, go out into the valley, and I will speak with you. So I arose and went out into the valley, and behold, the glory of the Lord stood there, like the glory that I had seen by the Chebar Canal, and I fell on my face. But the Spirit again entered into me and set me on my feet, and he spoke with me and said, Go, shut yourself within your house. And you, O son of man, behold, cords will be placed upon you, and you shall be bound with them, so that you cannot go out among the people. And I will make your tongue cling to the roof of your mouth, so that you shall be mute and unable to reprove them, for they are a rebellious house. But when I speak with you, I will open your mouth, and you will say to them, Thus says the Lord God. He who will hear, let him hear. And he who will refuse to hear, let him refuse, for they are a rebellious house. This is just the beginning of Ezekiel's ministry. What happens as a result of this encounter with God? Where does God send him? Back to his house. And it says cords will be bound around you. Now, we don't know if that's literally. He literally ties himself to a chair, or whether God removes from him the ability to move his muscles. But one way or the other, he's stuck, sitting in his home. A moment ago, he walked to the valley, and he encountered the glory of God, and God said, Go back to your home, and you'll never leave there. You will be bound there. Well, hold on. That doesn't sound comfortable. That doesn't sound really like what I envisioned. I kind of saw myself maybe being like John the Baptist, perhaps, although he didn't know him, and wandering the valley and, you know, kind of, at least I get locust and honey. I mean, it's not great, but it's not terrible. God says, no, you're bound. You are now going to need somebody to provide even for your basic needs. I am binding you to the chair. And if that weren't bad enough, I am causing your tongue to cleave to the roof of your mouth. You can't even say anything about what your needs are, about what your intentions are, about what your hope is. Only what you can say is when I unlock your lips and let you speak. That was the call of God on Ezekiel. And it gets worse. God continues with Ezekiel to use the imagery of Ezekiel's life to pull out the picture of his relationship with Jerusalem. Ezekiel loves his wife. And God says, tomorrow morning she's going to die and you can't grieve. Not one solitary tear. You can't take your hat off and grieve in that way. You can't even cover your mouth in sorrow. When people come to mourn with you, you send them packing. Tell them, I have no mourning. And it would be one thing if it were maybe a prostitute that you married in the market, but this is not. This is the love of your life. He uses Solomon-esque type language of this lady, and she dies because God said, that's like what's going to happen when my nation dies. And Ezekiel, that's what I'm calling to you. Ezekiel, you have to lay on one side for 390 days and then for 40 days on the other side, because that's a picture or image of what it's like with my nation. Ezekiel was called to be used up by God. And we look at this and we think, okay, well, what are we supposed to do with this? I called this encounter with God discovering a new calling. And I did that on purpose, because when we hear that word, discovering a new calling, immediately we think, oh, well, that sounds magnificent. You know, a new calling. I get to step into something new and wonderful, and I get to walk in goodness with God. And what was the new calling that God had for Ezekiel? What was his plan before? Priest, servant, scribe for God. I mean, he had a lot of good things going. He was one of the magnificent ones in his nation. What is the new calling God has for him? Vegetable, tied to your seat, unable to move and only speak. And not just that, but the blood of the entire nation is laid at your account. That's your calling, Ezekiel. And we look at that and we think, whoa, does that what an encounter with God can do? And the answer is yes. Why is that? Are we okay with that? Are we comfortable with that? I recognize this is not happy. This is sad. I feel very badly. Listen, they called Jeremiah the weeping prophet and the prophet of lamentation. Dude, this guy had it worse. This was awful. Are we okay with God using him that way, or does that seem unfair? Are we okay with God taking his freedom from him, taking his wife from him, taking his own national pride and interest from him? Are we okay with that? Well, yeah, because it was him, not us. But the fact of the matter is that God is permitted, not just permitted, but has absolute authority to do whatever he wants with our life. Absolute authority. And we somehow get under the impression that this encounter with God will give me this wondrous, wonderful, lovely life. Listen, Ezekiel had a great life. But it was great because God was magnified through him. And God used him in a magnificent way. And God used the prophecy of Ezekiel to portray hope to the nation of Israel and to the future. He describes the new restored temple. He describes the wonderful restoration of the nation as Jerusalem is rebuilt and the glory of God again comes down and dwells among men. He describes those wondrous. He sees the wonder and majesty of God, but it was because God used him as he would and as he will. It's a difficult reality, but it's part of the lesson that we encounter as we say, God, show me your glory. Anybody who wants to see and know God and to be drawn near to God needs to understand that it's unconditional. It's not God, show me the good stuff about you. It's not God, show me how I can know more of you so that it benefits me. It's God, show me your character and your nature and use me however you will. In spite of what I want, in spite of what I love, in spite of what is valuable to me, be magnified in my life. And it results often in trouble, in sorrow, but ultimately in the magnification of the goodness and greatness of God. We don't know of this. Modern Christianity doesn't know of this because we've abandoned this kind of God. We have rather built him in an image that benefits us because we're convinced that's what he's here for. But we're here to magnify his nature and character. That's the essence. So the lessons that we learn here. We don't understand all that we see and experience and encounter with God. Listen, I tell you right now, Ezekiel had no clue. He didn't even tell us what all this stuff was. Sometimes you want to hear from him. So what was with the wheels exactly? I mean, what was that all about? I don't know. Neither does he. There's a lot of people that have a lot of ideas. And some of those ideas sound pretty good. But we weren't told. Neither was he. He was just shown. Look, this is my glory. When we encounter God, we don't always necessarily understand or entirely know what we experience in that encounter. Probably even Ezekiel didn't understand everything he saw. But in his encounter with God, he understood to whom he talked. He knew who he was talking with. That was all that really mattered. He recognized who it was he was talking with. And it was God. He understood what he was supposed to do and what he was to say. That's all that mattered. He didn't know the details behind it, apparently. All he knew was what God had told him. And we are very uncomfortable with that. We would much rather, in our encounter with God, know all the details, all the specifics, all the ability. We have the ability to attach this to something practical and pragmatic that we can work on. But God says, no, I am God, you are not. I will do what I will do, you do what I tell you to do. The encounter with God gave him a new vision or direction in his life. Yeah, totally new. Ezekiel got a vision of God in his encounter with him. And received a twofold message. There was twofold message that you see in the book of Ezekiel. First, to warn Israel of her stiff neck or that hard-headedness that she has, that rebellion. And second, to write the predictions about the new temple of God that would be built in the future. Ezekiel had a very specific purpose that God used him up for. And you look at that and you recognize the fact that God was doing his business. God was doing with Ezekiel what needed done at that moment in time. This is not necessarily what you would normally classify or consider to be this wonderful encounter with God message. But I think we need to know and understand this piece of it. Because I think we misunderstand often what it is we're pursuing. When we say, God, use me to magnify as a glass, to magnify the glory of your character, we need to recognize that it may very well change entirely our call. Our purpose, our direction, our intentions and plans. We have to be willing to serve and love God entirely, even if it means hardship, trouble, toil. Listen, I don't begrudge Ezekiel's 7-day overwhelm status. And apparently neither does God. He gives him 7 days to just sink into the reality of this call. And when he says, my heart, my spirit was grieved, I was heavy, the hand of God was heavy upon me. Listen, he is not necessarily this example that we look to and say, look at his surrender. We can't know. I mean, on the one hand, maybe he was very surrendered to God. He does everything God tells him to do. But on the other hand, God says, don't be rebellious. And God binds him to his chair and closes his mouth and only lets him say what he wants him to say. I mean, at some level, you could argue that Ezekiel becomes a forced servant in God's army. And yet God continues, even in that, to use Ezekiel as an example of the kind of relationship that God, the kind of ownership that God wants of us. Be careful what you ask for. Be careful of this encounter of God. It will be wonderful, but it may seem terrible. Are you okay with that? That's really the question. God, thank you so much for the fact that you sovereignly use us. And God, we have an obligation and a privilege, Lord, to be willing to be used by you. Lord, it's astounding when we look at this illustration. It's disconcerting, Lord. It's uncomfortable to think of a God who would do this to a guy. It's a little bit off-putting. But God, you are sovereign. You are king. You, Lord, deserve our life. You've bought it. You've made it. It belongs to you. And Lord, it's easy to look at the situation and to think it's unfair, but God, fairness is bound up in your will. Whatever you will, Lord, is the fair and a right and appropriate thing. God, help us to catch a vision of this type of glory, terrifying and terrible as it may be. Transform our understanding of what it means to be used by God and to see you high and lifted up. So that, Lord, our church, us individually in our church and your universal church, Lord, will all come together in a magnificent display of a surrendered heart and will and a willingness to say and do whatever you ask. Lord, thank you for your grace. Thank you for your goodness. Lord, when we look at this, immediately we think it must have been awful, but God, you were in this. And so even in the midst of it, Lord, you were still loving and good because that's part of who you are also. Even the terrifying, terrible words of woe, when they come from your hand, can be sweet because they represent that you care, that you're continuing to reach out in love to us rebellious, stiff-headed people. Thank you that you have that type of grace. Help us to know and love and revel in that as well. In your name we pray. Amen.